It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Several small fires continue to burn at the site of a West Virginia train derailment near Mount Carbon, West Virginia, on the Kanawha River. 27 of the 109 cars derailed and 19 were involved in fires. Reportedly, only one person was injured. As the cleanup continues and investigators continue to sift through the rubble of the accident that occurred on Monday, I'm joined now by phone by Dave Mistich, digital editor for West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Good day, Dave.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What is happening at the scene of the derailment today?
Well, the last we've heard that there are inspectors on site from the National Transportation Safety Board, as well as the Federal Railroad Administration. Also, crews from the U.S. Coast Guard, the State Department of Environmental Protection, as well as the federal EPA.
And the fire is still, or at least there are small fires still burning.
Yes, I just got off the phone a little bit ago with the DEP spokeswoman, Kelly Gillenwater, here in West Virginia. She said that there are at least one small fire, or at least one small fire is still burning there. So,
and I understand that none of the cars, none of the rail cars entered the river. Is that correct?
That is correct. Initially, the State Department of Military Affairs and Public Safety sent out a release, I believe it was Monday afternoon. It said that it did appear that one or maybe more had made its way into the river, but they took that back and said that it appears now that that's not the case. I think the confusion lies in that there was fire right along the bank there, and people thought that there was a tanker car in the river, but we found out that actually wasn't the case at all.
So that certainly is some good news there. What are the top priorities for response personnel at the site right now, 3 days after the accident?
Sure. It's my understanding that yesterday the DEP and other crews there vacuumed out about 5,000 gallons of oil and water mixture that was in the creek there. It's called Armstrong Creek. It's right there. It runs right into the Kanawha River. And they've also deployed about 500 feet of containment boom. So it seems like right now cleanup and just getting things contained is the main issue right now. And then they'll move along to the investigation.
And what might they be looking for? And has anybody discussed at this point in an official capacity the cause or potential causes of the accident and the derailment?
Sure. Well, I'm seeing right now that some news is coming out about the speed of the train, and the Unified Command Center, which is run by the U.S. Coast Guard. It's the team of all the state, local, and federal investigators and response teams. They're saying that speed was not a factor, and that investigators said the train was traveling at 33 miles per hour at the time of the crash. The Federal Railroad Administration's acting administrator, Sarah Feinberg, told West Virginia Metro News this morning, which is another radio station here in Charleston, that the train was traveling at 33 miles per hour and it wasn't speeding. So,
it was not speeding. What about weather? Was that any kind of factor?
You know, we haven't heard anything about that yet. I spoke with the former managing director of the National Transportation Safety Board. His name is Peter Goles. Peter told me yesterday that extreme cold and extreme heat can affect the railway. But investigators haven't made any conclusions on that at this point. But he did make that point to say that, you know, extreme weather conditions can play a part in some way.
So in terms of how it affects the railway, it just makes it slicker, or is there some other type of problem?
No, he wasn't necessarily specific about that. I can't really speak to that. He just said that extreme weather conditions can affect the railway.
There were a number of residents who were evacuated from the area. What is the status for those people living in that area near where the derailment occurred?
Well, I think a few of those folks have gone home. It's my understanding that there are a few still out there and displaced, I guess, is a way to put it. The folks that I talked to whenever I went down Tuesday described it, one woman described it like being in hell. So I think people are a little afraid of the situation still, but I think things are getting a little bit back to normal. There was one gentleman that lost his home, and luckily his wife wasn't home, but I read a report late last night that he had ran out of his house in his socks. So that gentleman lost his home, but I think things are getting cleaned up as the best they can at this point. So,
what are the concerns that people have about contaminants in that area and about whether the water is safe to drink?
Well, both initially they had shut down two intakes. West Virginia American Water is the company that owns two treatment plants and intakes there along the Kanawha River downstream from the accident. And initially both of those intakes were shut down, but by, I believe it was yesterday morning, both of them were back up and running and things were, water wasn't necessarily an issue. That all came out of testing samples from the river collected by the National Guard and testing being conducted by the water company and so forth. They determined that there was no threat to the water. And again, they say that that no oil made its way into the Kanawha River. So that was the cause for concern in that regard is sort of pretty much been eliminated. So
we're talking with Dave Mistich. He's digital editor for West Virginia Public Broadcasting about the train derailment near Mount Carbon, West Virginia, earlier this week. 27 of the 109 cars derailed. 19 were involved in fires, but fortunately, no one died in the incident. One person was injured, and the tanker cars that initially were described as having gone into the river, apparently that was untrue. None of those cars went into the river, the Kanawha River near Mount Carbon. And water is now water service has now been restored to all customers in the area. So some good news coming out of there, but still a big mess. And Dave Mistich, the big takeaway from this is the apparent failure of safer tank cars to prevent an explosion. What are people saying about this?
Well, you know, again, I talked to the former managing director of the NTSB, Peter Goles. He told me that, you know, that these CPC 1232s are an improvement on the DOT 111s, which is the earlier model. But he like he said, and like I'm reading elsewhere, that, you know, transporting crude by rail is something that we can always be getting better at. So I think the takeaway is that, you know, while some improvements have been made, obviously with an incident like this, there is work to be done in making sure that this is a safe way to transport crude oil. So,
and Dave, in your conversation with the NTSB official, how did he say these newer cars are better than the ones previously used?
Well, you know, in doing some research, I believe that there's some reinforcements on the thickness of the hull there. And also some valves and decompression accessories, I guess you'd say, on these tanker cars. So
the cars are better. They are better reinforced. And so it's thought that they are safer, but they were still involved in an accident. And I'm sure that there are still people worried because these trains, similar trains, rumble through that area daily. So if a safer tank car did not prevent this from happening, what are the worries that safety officials in that area have as a result of this?
I think there's a lot. Interestingly enough, and this needs pointed out, is that the railroads are required by the Obama administration and the Federal Department of Transportation to provide crude oil shipment data to state emergency management teams. Interestingly enough, the state of West Virginia will not release that data publicly, which includes maps of the railway system as well as how much is being transported each week through each county. And again, that's in West Virginia. They're not giving us that data. They say it's proprietary. They say it's a matter of security. But other states, like in yours in Pennsylvania, that information has been made public. So
that's great. I'm really glad you pointed that out, Dave, because the rules are different from state to state. As a reporter trying to get at this information, how frustrating is that for you? And what are some of the recourse that you have as a reporter legally as part of your constitutional rights to try to get at that information?
Well, you know, FOIA requests were made back in October by a reporter here in Charleston, Ken Ward, who was asking for that information. He was turned down. Other folks, the Associated Press has made a FOIA request. All kinds of media outlets across West Virginia have been asking for this information. So it is rather frustrating, to say the least. At this point, I filed a FOIA request for communication between the rail company CSX and the State Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, just to see if there were any talks between the two parties. But we'll see if anything comes out of that. But as of right now, they're not releasing that information. To say the least, it is rather frustrating. So,
we have a caller on the line, Cynthia from Pittsburgh. She has a question. Cynthia, welcome. You are on the air with Dave Mistich, who is a digital editor for West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I find myself wondering about sort of who's footing the bill for these accidents. You know, you've mentioned emergency crews and the National Guard and the EPA, water treatment intakes were shut down, and I also read that the university was shut down temporarily. So I'm curious to know if taken together, are these significant costs and do they add up to something of a subsidy?
Interesting question. I don't know if Dave can answer that, but what do you know about Cynthia's question, Dave?
As far as that goes, I can't tell you at that point. At this point, I do know that for whatever it's worth, CSX has provided hotels and meals and water initially to some of the families that were displaced. And, obviously, as far as cleanup goes, I can't really say. I think it remains to be seen, after something like this happens, exactly who does foot the bill for it. So,
Cynthia, thank you for that call. And I should mention at this point that for the purpose of this conversation, we did attempt to contact officials at CSX, as well as the Association of American Railroads and the American Petroleum Institute, about having representatives from their organizations take part in this conversation. We received no response from CSX, and representatives from the American Petroleum Institute and the Association of American Railroads simply said that there was no one available today, at least, to take part in this conversation, although we are expecting to line something up with an official from the Association of American Railroads sometime on a show in the near future. In the meantime, Dave Mistich, thank you so much for the update. Anything we should know about that's happening today as far as the latest developments?
It's slowing down, I guess you'd say, at this point. Like I said, containment continues on site. The booms are out. I believe that once they get all the fires out, that they're going to be taking a look at soil testing. That'll be from the state DEP, I believe. Right now it's just containment and making sure that things can be cleaned up so that the actual investigation can begin. And then once, fires are out, they'll be transferring oil from the damaged cars to other tanks to get off-site, getting and I believe at this point that the tankers that weren't involved in the derailment are being moved already. So things are moving along, I guess. So.
Well, not surprising that the cleanup is taking this long, and perhaps not surprising either that small fires continue to burn at the site after the fireball that made national news, that people all over the country saw after that accident on Monday. We've been talking with Dave Mistich. He's digital editor for West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Dave, great thanks.
Appreciate it.
Coming up, with trains hauling crude oil passing regularly through Pittsburgh, what can be done to prevent a similar accident here? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. According to records provided by railroads under a federal government emergency order last year, each week up to 75 trains, each loaded with at least 1 million gallons of crude oil, pass through Allegheny County. Trains hauling crude oil from North Dakota and Montana to East Coast refineries regularly pass through downtown Pittsburgh. A year ago this month, 21 cars of a Norfolk Southern freight train carrying crude oil derailed in Vandergrift. And a month before that, 7 cars of a 101-car train left the tracks on a bridge over the Schuylkill River and Schuylkill Expressway in Philadelphia. What concerns should this raise for those who oversee the industry as well as environmental groups? What steps need to be taken to protect highly populated areas? I'm joined now in Studio A by Evan Endres. He's program manager at the Energy Center for Penn Future, an environmental advocacy organization. Evan Endres, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me.
We contacted the Association of American Railroads, as well as the American Petroleum Institute, and representatives of CSX about having representatives from their organizations take part in this conversation, but none was available. In our previous segment, Evan, we talked about the apparent failure of safer tank cars to prevent an explosion in the West Virginia derailment. Let's talk about the difference between these cars and others used in the past.
Sure. So the cars that were used that were involved in the incident in West Virginia are CPC 1232 cars, and they represent sort of an upgrade of the DOT 111 cars that we've been so concerned about with this issue. I think the question is do they go far enough? The CPC 1232s are about a 2011 era upgrade, and they certainly have safety features over and above the DOT 111 cars.
And the DOT 111 cars, for example, they were the ones that were involved in the horrific accident. If you want to go to your worst case scenario, that would be the incident that happened in Quebec a few years back.
Correct. They represent that car with a few extra safety features, if you will. So they're better, but are they good enough to protect us from these kinds of incidents? And I think this accident in West Virginia brings up a lot of those questions. And how are we going to settle for this 1232 standard, or are we going to go above and beyond? And how long are those 1232 cars going to be in operation? If they're not good enough, how long are we going to settle for a slightly safer car over the DOT 111?
I don't know how much you can speak to the science of this, but why didn't these cars work better? They were supposed to be an improvement over the ones, the DOT 111s, and yet based on what happened on Monday, can we say that they really are better?
Well, I think first what we have to remember is that we are transporting a hazardous material by rail, okay? And we need to get to a standard that allows us to do that as safely as possible if there is a safe way to do it. So it's not just the cars. Is it the braking systems? Is it the condition of the rails? The speaker that you had before talked about cold and heat being a factor in that.
Because the metal would expand and contract in those in extreme weather?
That could have been the case. I don't know. But these factors, it's more than just wrapping this volatile compound into explosion-proof wrapping, if you will. There's got to be more consideration for that. There's got to be infrastructure, braking, operations. Is there anything we can do on the front end where this stuff is coming out of the oil fields to make it safer? Is there any other processes that it should be going through to siphon off the volatile elements or the corrosive elements? Every level of this issue needs to be looked at, and rules that are designed to answer to those concerns, they need to be comprehensive. They need to be cradle-to-grave kinds of issues, or if you will, oil field to refinery issues, and that needs to be a comprehensive action plan. But I think the question still remains: do we have the capacity to enforce new rules? How long are we going to tolerate the industry stalling the layout of this new equipment? All these are really important issues, and I guess I just want to remind everybody that Pennsylvania has been very lucky. We've had close calls in this state, not just in western Pennsylvania, but near Philly, near highly populated areas. We've had crude oil spills out of these types of the DOT 111, not the CPC 1232s, but we have had incidents in the state. We've been very lucky that these incidents haven't been as horrific as Lac-Mantique or West Virginia. And I think we need to be asking ourselves, not only at the federal level, but at the state level, are we doing enough to protect the health, safety, and well-being of our citizens?
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking with Evan Endres. He's program manager at the Energy Center for Penn Future, an environmental advocacy organization. If you have a comment or question for him, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002, 412-246-2002, the number to call. Email is ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. Evan, in our previous segment, you know, we were talking about these safer tank cars and what happened in West Virginia. Is this the fact that this incident involved tank cars that meet internal industry standards an indication that self-policing within the industry is not sufficiently protecting the public?
With the volume of traffic and the risk posed by this material, I would say that self-policing is not a standard that we should settle for as citizens.
Should there be, as far as you're concerned, an outright ban on some of these cars?
That's a difficult question, but certainly the DOT-111s need to be phased out as soon as possible.
Now, the railroad industry is saying that they favor retrofitting or phasing out older cars like the DOT-111s over a period of several years. It could take years.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at the potential of 1, 2, 3 years, perhaps even down the road or more, mm-hmm. that the dangerous cars or those that have been called dangerous, the DOT-111s, would still be rolling down the tracks mm-hmm. with all that crude oil rolling through downtown Pittsburgh. Is it being done fast enough?
No, it's not. We should not be tolerating delays. I think we were first talking about a 2-year timeline. Now there's been efforts to even stall that out further. In talking about the other car, the slightly better than DOT-11 car, we're likely to see those on the rails for the next decade. We shouldn't tolerate that either. I think the excuse that's being used by the industry is this will cost us too much, or they say that whatever we can't transport by rail, we'll start putting on your highways. How would you like that? These are the kinds of sort of non-solutions that we shouldn't be tolerating as a rebuttal from the industry.
Again, our number to join the conversation, 412-246-2002, 412-246-2002. What questions do you have about the crude oil cars, the tank cars that rumble through Pittsburgh? What concerns do you have about how this could impact safety in your neighborhood? 412-246-2002, the number to call. Has the did the industry kind of get out ahead of the oil boom without stopping to consider what the regulations should be? For example, you know, we've got this big oil boom happening in North Dakota. Let's get the oil out to other parts of the country. How fast can we do it? How much volume can we put down on those tracks? I mean, there's money to be made. People need this for, you know, any number of energy policy reasons. So we're going to do it, and perhaps without giving enough consideration to safety and regulatory concerns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, again, we're looking at unprecedented volume of traffic here, and you know,
and this really started what? I mean, the real boom in North Dakota was it's been within the last decade.
Right, right, absolutely. And we did see the CPC 1232 car is as of 2011 was sort of a voluntary standard that the industry actually set out for itself. So there was some proactive action there in 2011. Whether that goes far enough, I think the real question is again, not just the cars, but is our infrastructure capable of handling this amount of risk? We have aged rails out there. Do we have enough inspectors? Do we have enough engineers? You know, it's a combination not just of the tanker cars and the material, but also the rails that they're on. So again, I think it's back to that question: is the industry capable of self-regulating? Well, is the industry regulating the rails? Or if we come to find that the West Virginia incident was because of a rail issue and not because of a car issue, then there's more than just the industry on the hook for that. So if we're going to be moving this kind of dangerous substance through our cities, through our towns, and then do we have all the resources that we need to continue to do that safely? And if not, then we need to make some quick decisions or bring together those resources to make that activity safer very quickly.
Are we in a situation where legislation is needed rather than leaving the issue to an administrative agency to go through this long rulemaking process?
Well, I think that of course you have the federal level, and this issue is sort of driven by federal regulation. I wouldn't be surprised if some representatives on the federal level came together to create some sort of rule or regulation, and I wouldn't be beyond encouraging them to look at that. But again, The other level of this is, what can the states do? Some states are taking it upon themselves to try to do whatever they can to have an impact on the safety issues regarding crude by rail. They're very limited in what they can do, but I think what Pennsylvania needs to be asking itself is, on the state level, are we doing everything that we can right now?
And I guess another question that I think some people might be surprised to learn is, and then we did learn in our first segment, was that there are different regulations from state to state. Why isn't there a federal standard? Why are states making their own regulations?
Well, there is a federal standard. The Federal Railroad Administration and their rules do supersede the state jurisdiction. So, for instance, you couldn't have a state that carries a tighter standard on the tanker cars than another state. So it wouldn't be like, oh, it's the trans coming from Ohio, and then we're going to take those older cars off the rail and put new cars on. That's just not the way it works.
So but information, for example, access to information,
right,
knowing what the train routes are, just the issues of transparency.
Mm-hmm.
In West Virginia, there's almost an information blackout.
Well, and I think what the states are citing in that case is security, homeland security issues, because of the potential for these trains to be so dangerous that they do carry a potential safety risk with them and could possibly be targets. So I do think that's what we're seeing cited by some of these states. Whether that is a valid concern or not, I can't tell for sure. But data access, as far as how many of these things are running through and what frequency, I mean, that is information that the state emergency management organizations are getting, and even in some level, that's trickling down to the city and larger towns.
It's Essential Pittsburgh, and my guest Evan Endres, program manager at the Energy Center for Penn Future, talking about the situation with oil tankers traveling not only through places like West Virginia, but the potential dangers that this poses to highly populated areas like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, where those trains run through the heart of downtown. We will take all of your calls, 412-246-2002. Lots of people holding. We will get to all of you. Let's start with Steve in Ohio Township. Steve, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I had a question in sort of related to the natural gas or the byproduct of the trains or the fracking. I was told that, or someone told me that, if they produce something which, whatever the byproduct of the chemicals that they're using to frack, they won't tell the FDA or the EPA what they're actually doing and what those byproducts do. Is that true? And how close are they more to resolving, if Bayer makes a drug and the side effects are X, Y, and Z, they have to go through clinical trials to prove the chemical. It's a 7-year process. How close are they to me? So for an industry not to tell you what the side effects are, is that true? And if so, what are they doing to resolve such an issue?
Well, let's kind of focus the question more on the tank cars. And you do raise a good point, Steve. And I think that in West Virginia, for example, you would assume that part of the NTSB investigation would be what sorts of chemicals were released as a result of that derailment. Even though none of those cars went into the river, obviously there was enough material was released to cause an incredible explosion. People are returning to their homes in that area. What do we know about the chemical residue from that accident? What should we know, Evan?
Well, we should know as much as we can, especially if there's waterways that are then attached to public water sources. I mean,
what is the government required to tell us? What is happening in West Virginia now? What questions should people down there be asking?
Well, I think they should be asking about water contamination for sure. They should be asking questions about how much of that substance made it into the soil, and is there a long term threat for migration of that substance into a waterway? Just because the problem isn't apparent right this moment, could it be apparent in the future? But I think it brings up an interesting point. We had a breach in Vandergrift last year, almost to the day, as you said, and that was not an explosion, but a spill. And although the fireballs are dramatic and very, very frightening, I think we should be just as concerned about water contamination from a Bakken crude oil spill. That has potentially far-reaching damaging effects, especially if it were to happen on one of our Allegheny or Mon River waterways, affecting the water supply for miles downstream. So even though the sort of emotional reaction to that fireball picture that we saw, is sort of a really cathartic and scary situation, that water contamination issue to me is just as frightening. The consequences economically are very far reaching for that level of water contamination.
And of course, Bakken crude is the type of oil that is being shipped from North Dakota east through places like Pittsburgh. Let's go to Beth from Royal Green County. Beth, you're on Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi there. First of all, I want to say thank you to Penn Future for all the information that you folks put out. And I do hope that, Evan, you can talk on the air about how people can get your email blast, because they are really educational, and I greatly appreciate them. My comment is that while I certainly appreciate the fact that we need to be very careful about what happens in Pittsburgh, because there's tons of people living there, please don't forget that all this stuff that you don't want in Pittsburgh because folks might get killed, we don't want it in rural Greene County because we might get killed too. And just because there's not that many of us doesn't mean that our lives are unimportant, and that's oftentimes what it feels like in these debates, and I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay, Beth, thank you for that point. I don't think that anybody is, diminishing this threat anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's just that fortunately in West Virginia, no one died. If the same thing happens in Pittsburgh in a highly populated area, I would think the chances are much greater that someone would die.
So let me speak to, I think, emergency preparedness, because I do think that's an issue that's brought up by this question. So, the city of Pittsburgh has far greater potential for human life impact on this just because of concentration of population. But they also get resources. They also get more resources sometimes than rural communities. So I think one question that the West Virginia incident brings up, and one thing that should be investigated, is who was the first responder on the ground in that small West Virginia community? And are our rural communities here in Western Pennsylvania equipped to deal with this? And if not, how do you get a volunteer fire department that would be the first responder to something that magnitude, equipped and comfortable with dealing with it to prevent loss of life and loss of property? And the question of those resources and where those resources come from has to be answered. And it may be a question that is worth posing to the larger cities as well.
And before we take another call, what should we know about the frequency of these trains? That we're told that it's been reported that the trains carrying the Bakken crude from North Dakota and Montana to East Coast refineries pass through the heart of Pittsburgh on a regular basis? I mean, how often is that?
Well, I can't speak to the frequency exactly, but what I do know is that when a crude shipment that has this volatile quality to it, a train bomb, if you will, passes through Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh Emergency Management and Homeland Security agents within the city are made aware that it's coming through. So there is sort of an alert system, if you will, that says that this is going to be shipped, and they know when that's coming through. So that information does make it down to that level. I think the question is, again, if there was an incident, and you know, after this West Virginia incident occurred, folks started talking about something that happened in Pittsburgh in the East End in the late 80s, which was a hazardous chemical spill related to a train, and many blocks of Shadyside were evacuated. So we know cities can respond to these, but do they have the resources? Do they have everything that they need to respond to a incident at the level of the Mount Carbon West Virginia incident?
412-246-2002, the number to call to join our conversation with Evan Endres, Program Manager at the Energy Center for Penn Future, an environmental advocacy organization. Let's go to Pat. Not sure where Pat's calling from. Hi, Pat. Where are you?
Am I on?
Yes, you are. You are on the air. And
okay. I have a couple different questions. The first one is concerning the Keystone Pipeline. I don't understand that we're going to build this pipeline for the Canadians to move Balkan crude. Why can't we just tap in and put our Balkan crude from Wyoming and Montana into that pipeline instead of shipping it through Pennsylvania?
Pat, hello. Well, let's address the first question. First of all, is it in fact the Keystone XL pipeline running from Canada, isn't that a different type of oil, the tar sands?
Yeah, that would be the Alberta tar sand oil going down to
Texas,
making its way to the refineries in the Gulf Coast. That's the idea behind that pipeline for sure. But there has been talk of other pipelines that would go to East Coast refineries, and we do have refining. The reason why there's so many oil cars going through the Pittsburgh area is because of that. The refining capacity that we have in Philadelphia, the end, and in New Jersey, the end destination for this oil is in Philadelphia in the New Jersey area and sort of that area there. So,
is it an either or situation where we could say if we built more pipelines, we wouldn't have to ship it by rail?
That's a really difficult question, and I guess the first thing that I want to say is that pipelines have issues too. For sure, we have oil
thus
breaches.
The debate, and
right?
Thus the attitude of the president that at this point he's going to veto any legislation that is
so. I think a really important question, and a really important question for Penn Future is what can we be doing to move off of this oil addiction that we're on right now? We have these shipments coming through because of this insatiable addiction to oil, and I certainly recognize that we need it now. But I think the supply and demand curve should inform us as to whether we need to be moving it this aggressively at all from those difficult to reach reserves in the Dakotas. And can we be moving those resources and those costs associated with bringing that oil and refining it to other sources of energy.
Certainly the political argument, and the president would agree with you on that. Pat, did you – a quick second question
I have another statement. I'm a software developer, and I've developed a lot of hazardous material software. And after 9/11, most of the on-road trucks, tanker trucks and so forth, have been improved as far as just the trucking industry. And you're required to file every hazardous material you're carrying with the federal government. And those are available if you look on websites. You could usually find out what the hazmats coming through your town is.
Well, and it depends.
I don't have the exact website. I'm in a car. But that was done, redone through in 2004, 2005.
Well, there's information in West Virginia about this accident that people are trying to get to and can't. So there are not – there's an issue with uniformity here, Pat, and I'm sorry to – let you go, but we need to move on. Let's go to Ted in Mount Washington. Hi, Ted. You're on Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, how y'all guys doing?
Good, good. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Real quick, I think your guest is bringing up an outstanding point, excellent point. My question is, what can average person do to really get safety standards? Because to me, especially in the urban population, it's just a matter of when. I mean, these rail cars are nothing but ticking time bombs. And I heard the mayor bring the subject up briefly. And, you know, and also, what's the influence of energy and also the railroad as far as, like, lobbying politicians? Mm-hmm. What kind of influence do they have?
Well, let me start, Ted. I think Ted brings up a point that a lot of Pittsburghers is close to our heart right now. I look at these trains with great trepidation and fear, especially since I can't remember the last time I saw a train come through Pittsburgh that didn't have DOT-11 cars. Now, whether those were hauling the back end crude or not, sometimes it's difficult to tell. There's a lot of different materials that could be hauled by that. But
how do you tell one car from another?
Just through naked observation? Yeah, they're placarded. There's a way to tell. There is. They're placarded with a number and a safety standard that allows first responders to identify what's in them.
Where is that? Let's say we're watching a train roll through Pittsburgh. Can we see that?
Yeah,
somewhere?
It's usually a it's a square panel on each of the cars, and it's usually down by the wheel. And I usually take notice when I see the flammable, but that doesn't the flammable placard. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a back end crude. It could be an ethanol or some other type of product. But it's certainly folks that, for instance, I live less than 200 yards from a railroad track, and that is something that you will hear from a lot of Pittsburghers. Many, many Pittsburghers live close enough that if there was an explosion, they would be either have to be evacuated or they could be instantly affected. So I think that I certainly reverberate your concerns, Ted. But I think what a citizen can do, and specifically what the at the local level. The mayor can do is first of all reassure folks that they have the resources that they need to manage an incident, and reassure folks that they are aware of what's coming through. But I would also sort of challenge the mayor to be vocal to federal decision makers and to state decision makers to do more. The city governments have very little control over what comes through. They have a lot of responsibility if there's an incident, but very little control over what comes through. But up the chain, I would also say that it's time for Pennsylvania to put together an intergovernmental panel or commission to investigate what else can be done at the state level. Maybe those options are limited, but maybe there are avenues and ways that the state can have more impact on the health and safety of this issue. Again, we've been very lucky in Pennsylvania. We've had a tremendous number of close calls. And over a long enough timeline, we will see an incident. We will certainly see an incident, whether it be significant water contamination from a spill or an explosion at on the level of what we've seen in West Virginia. Unless something's done, it will happen.
We will link if you go to our website, WESA.FM, we'll have a link to Penn Futures. You can find out more information about our discussion of tank cars carrying crude oil through highly populated and not so highly populated areas of the region. Evan Endres is program manager at the Energy Center for Penn Future, an environmental advocacy organization. Thank you so much for being with us.
Paul, thank you very much.
We did try to contact representatives of the industry, including the Association of American Railroads. We hope to be continuing this conversation with a representative of at least that organization in one of our shows in the immediate future here on Essential Pittsburgh. Coming up right now, we have our travel contributor, Elaine LeBaum, with some ideas on ski vacations. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The saying goes, everyone talks about the weather, but no one does anything about it. Well, when faced with the snow we've been experiencing, travel contributor Elaine LeBaum, who tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town, suggests strapping on some skis and hitting the slopes. New Girl, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
Cold enough for you, Paul?
Yeah, well, cold enough to keep certain offspring out of school.
There we go. My wingman sitting next to me, yeah. Steve-O.
All right, Steve-O. Well, you'll take him with you, right, if you go on a ski trip?
Absolutely.
It appears there will be no shortage of snow for late-season skiing this year. So is this the case in both the eastern and western U.S.? And if so, what should we do?
Well, here's the deal. This is the one season in a while now when we have got serious, serious bragging rights. The five snowiest cities in the U.S. so far this season: Worcester, Mass., Buffalo, Erie, PA, Boston, and Syracuse, New York.
That's like a trick question. You'd think Boston would be number one. Worcester's right next to Boston,
not
but it's
far.
Not Boston.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's funny. Sometimes when the storms come through, it's a little narrow swath. They'll suddenly dump, you know, mm-hmm. 3 feet of snow mm-hmm. on one town, and there you go.
So but then you want to ski.
You want to ski, and let me tell you, we're looking at the East Coast, little resorts that you wouldn't ordinarily think of.
Such as.
I say go to Blue Hill Ski Resort right outside of Boston, Canton, Mass. You're there 40 minutes outside of Boston. You can even take the Amtrak. 108-inch base this year. It's a terrific choice. Some of the best lift ticket prices I've seen anywhere, $40. You can get them as low as $30 if you just want to do night skiing. And they are open 9 to 9 every day. I think this is like your after-work little commute to go ski. It's not a huge mountain, but you know what? It's got some blue and black runs, too. Something for everyone. I say, you know, fly into Boston, head over, and just seriously good snow conditions right outside of Boston.
You say that Hunter Mountain in upstate New York has also received a ton of snow this winter.
You know, this one in the Catskill, same thing, 108-inch base, just a ton of snow this year. You can right now get a season pass for $239. You can fly into New York. You're there within a couple hours. If you wanted to drive, you get up at the crack of dawn in Pittsburgh. In 7 hours, you're skiing there in the afternoon. So for those gonzo skiers who just want seriously good snow conditions, Hunter Mountain in New York, I'd send you right there.
Snowshoe Mountain in West Virginia, a little closer, and they have lots of snow this season.
We know they do. They certainly have, where it is, southern West Virginia, they do get more snow than the Pittsburgh and southwest PA region. They've had 119 inches of snow this season. Right now they've got something that they're selling called the Ridiculous Pass for $229. You have to buy it by February 26th, but you can ski for the rest of the season, which may go on till early April this year. It's in the Allegheny Mountains. They just opened a sweet little boutique hotel on the mountain called the Corduroy Inn, so even think a little bit of romance there in southern West Virginia. Ski weekend.
Put on your corduroys and
go ski the corduroy. Yeah.
For those who have to have that West Coast powder, you like Beaver Creek in Colorado.
Well, you know, Beaver Creek has been in the news a lot lately because they just hosted the World Alpine Ski Championships. And I mean, this is a beautiful mountain. I skied there many years ago. Lux top of the line. They've got this thing going on. They call it White Glove First Tracks. If you're willing to put down some serious money, in this case $125, it's like that Disney lets you in an hour before everybody else. You get to go to the top of the mountain with a guide before the mountain is open, and you ski for an hour, and then they fix you a gourmet breakfast. And you think $125 for the pleasure might be worth it if you want that super, super sweet powder. But
sounds like fun.
Yeah, I would say, you know, go experience Beaver Creek. There's a gazillion trails there and a lot of double diamond stuff.
We have about 20 seconds to talk about Taos in New Mexico.
I love Taos. And the neat thing there is that the temps are great. They're in the 40s. So you're going to get some warm skiing. They've had enough snow this year. A little bit pricey on the lift ticket, $60, $70. But being in Taos for a long weekend or a week, there's so many things to do there. Explore the Native American culture. Great Southwest Tex-Mex type food. It's lunchtime. It always comes to food.
I tell you. Yeah, you never. This was the first. I thought we might actually get through a conversation without talking about food, but no. And you need to sustain yourself out on those.
Absolutely.
I remember when I was in France in Val d'Isère, they had hot lemonade. You know, you drink that on the way down.
Whoa,
warms you right up on a cold day like today.
You know the places.
Elaine LeBaum. That's like the only European thing I can name drop. Elaine LeBaum is our travel contributor. Thanks as always, Elaine.
Happy to be here.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. We're out of time. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.